Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs. All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding, and I'm your host, John Hansen. And welcome to February. We are now in the month of February for 2020. Today, we are actually going to have an interview. I don't think we've done an interview on the show. We've just been doing recaps and stuff for the last few weeks. Of course, we did our end of the year recap with Jerry Branum, where we went back 30, 40, and 50 years. So 2019 just ended. So we talked about 1969, 1979, and 1989. Those were always fun. And I want to thank Jerry for taking that 3 hours of his life to talk to us about all those subjects from all those years. And then the last 3 weeks, we've done recaps of our two-year anniversary for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So I had a lot of fun getting some of those old clips from some previous shows from our last 2 years, especially the last year. And so today we have an actual interview, as I said, with Roger Schwab, one of our old friends from the show. Roger was the head judge for the IFBB during the late 1970s. So he's got a lot of experience as a judge, and he saw a lot of those great contests from the golden era of bodybuilding up close. And today we're going to talk about a variety of subjects with Roger. One of them is women's bodybuilding. We're going to talk about when women's bodybuilding started back in the late 70s, early 80s, and how popular it was. And Roger was right there during all that time. So he's got a lot of thoughts on that subject. So then I think we are going to also talk about Mike Mentzer, because many of you may not know this, but Roger was good friends with Mike Mentzer. They both grew up in Pennsylvania. And Roger actually trained with Mike many times. And he trained with him right before the 1980 Mr. Olympia, before Mike left for Australia, which was his last competition ever. So we've got a really interesting conversation coming up with Roger Schwab. And I think we're also going to talk about the last year of 2019 and the passing, of course, of Ed Corney and Franco Colombo and Josef Wilkosch from Germany. So that's going to be a really interesting conversation with Roger Schwab that'll be coming up in a minute. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. It's the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner called Vintage Burn. It's the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner. Or Vintage Blast, which is their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right. What else is going on, guys? I am back in training. It feels great to be back in the gym. I'm getting in shape. Lost a little bit of fat this last month, so I hope your January went good also. I have to mention my seminar that I've got coming up. It's in 7 more weeks. It'll be March 21st and 22nd. If you're on my YouTube page or my Facebook page, you can see I made a video promoting the seminar. It's going to be a 2-day seminar. It'll be here in Tampa, Florida, where I'm at the Powerhouse Gym. As I mentioned over the last couple of weeks, this is going to be a combination of a classroom setting with in-the-gym training. So if you are into training and you want to learn about what makes a muscle grow and the best way to put together a workout routine and how important recuperation is and how to do the right diet for whether you're trying to gain muscle or lose fat and hold on to your muscle, this is the seminar for you guys. I've got over 40 years experience, so looking forward to this extensive 2-day seminar. Of course, I've been doing seminars since the 1980s, but I've never done like a real extensive 2-day seminar, which is going to be probably like an 8-hour, 9-hour day for 2 days. So it's going to really be great. So if you're interested in signing up for it, we are going to limit the class size to only 15 people, because when we do the in the gym training, I'm going to be training each person one-on-one. So I'll have a couple people helping me out, of course, setting up workout stations and everything. But I'm going to make sure everybody there gets my individual attention. So we cannot have too many people. So we're going to limit it to 15 people. So if you want to get your spot and you want to sign up, go to johnhansonfitness.com and you can just sign up right online. And like I said, it'll be in Tampa, Florida on March 21st and 22nd. And I'm not sure where you guys are at, but Tampa in March is beautiful because it's the warm weather, the sunshine, but we don't have that humidity that comes in the summertime because in March, the humidity is still really low. So it's a great vacation spot. You guys can come out for hopefully a few more days than just the seminar. So that is the big news in my life right now. I'm just promoting that. We've got the John Hansen Fitness Challenge going on right now. So all the people who joined up for that, I think they're now in their second week. So I check in with everybody every week, once a week, to make sure everybody's on track. And man, some of these people made some great progress in only 1 week. One guy lost like 3/4 of an inch off his waist in 1 week. So I know some of that happens when you first start a diet and you haven't been on a diet in a while, but great start for a lot of these people who are in it. So it's going to be a win-win situation for everybody involved. So I'm glad to see we had so many people get into that. I did another interview with Dave Palumbo this week for his RX Muscle show. We talked about the rivalry between Frank Zane and Franco Colombo. Because remember the last interview I did a few weeks ago, we talked about Arnold versus Sergio, which got a lot of hits. A lot of people, I think, I can't remember how many thousands of people watched that video on YouTube. So this one, we're talking about Franco versus Frank Zane. So I talked about all the contests they were in together, all the Mr. Olympias, and how Frank used to beat Franco quite regularly back in the NABBA universe before they both started competing in the Olympia. So it was an interesting conversation, and that should probably be up on RX Muscle on YouTube, on their YouTube channel, probably this week. So look for that. And I was also doing interviews for that Desktop Bodybuilding, which is also on YouTube. Xavier is the guy who runs that, and he's out of Australia. So we taped a few of those shows, but thought there'd be another one up this week. I thought he was putting them every week, but maybe it'll be next week. So look for that also if you're on YouTube. I got some good interviews coming up next week. Keep your fingers crossed. I'm not going to say who it is right now, but if you listen to our interview with Roger Schwab and you listen to the end of the interview, at the end of the interview, I'm going to announce who it is. So you got to listen to the interview with Roger Schwab. And at the end of the interview, I'm going to announce who our guest is next week. You guys will really be surprised. So check that out. Don't cheat. Don't cheat. Don't fast forward to the end of the interview. But just listen to the interview with Roger Schwab. And when it's over, you'll hear it. I think that's all I got for opening because we don't have any emails from last week. Hopefully, we'll get some emails for this show. You want to email me about anything, about any guests you want to hear, or any comments you have on the show, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. I also have a new article up on our website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And I've got an article about the very first Mr. Olympia in 1965. And of course, we've talked about that contest on this show, on this podcast, many, many times. So I wrote a little article about that. So if you go to the website, I don't know if you guys go to the website as well as listening to the podcast, go to the website at bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And we have the article right up there if you want to check that out. I'm going to be posting articles every so often now on the website just to get more people to come to the website. And speaking of websites, like I said, I got my johnhansonfitness.com website up. I've got a whole bunch of programs. I got a few people sign up this last month in January for competitions they're getting ready for. So they sign up for my contest prep program, which lasts anywhere from 16 to 18 weeks. So if you want to sign up for anything, whether it's losing fat, gaining muscle, off-season training, I've even got a program that lasts a whole year. You can work with me for a whole year. Just go to johnhansonfitness.com under programs and check out all the options I got available. All right. So here is our interview with Roger Schwab, where we talk about a variety of subjects, including the beginning of women's bodybuilding and Roger training with Mike Mentzer. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legend Show. And my guest this week is one of my favorite guests, Roger Schwab. And Roger was around during some of the pivotal moments of bodybuilding in the 1970s. He was a head judge at the Mr. Olympia contest in the late 1970s, and he was a head judge at many bodybuilding, top IFBB bodybuilding shows, and he was friends to a lot of the top bodybuilders. So I thought we would bring Roger on to start off the new year, 2020. Hey, Roger, how you doing?
Hey, John, how are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Yeah.
It was a tough week last week because you probably saw it on my post on Facebook, but a close friend of mine, Stacey Bentley, passed away.
In her early 60s,
and she was the first person I had ever hired at Mainline Nautilus to work for me way back in 1976.
Wow.
And she was a very close personal friend. And as you know, and as I mentioned, John Balick, who was later the publisher of Iron Man, who trained with us at the time, he could recognize an untrained woman's potential fine lines, and he did. And as I mentioned, he took Stacy out to California, and she trained at Gold's Gym with John and Arnold, all the guys in the mid to late 70s. And she, along with Lisa Lyons, Claudia Wilburn, even Rachel, were the pioneers for women's bodybuilding. And these were great days because they were natural days. And Stacy just had these beautiful lines, natural lines. I don't think she ever took a chemical, bodybuilding chemical in her life. And those were just the days, you know, and I'm just fortunate that I was there at a time when bodybuilding was, if not pure and innocent, nothing in the way that it has transpired today.
Right, exactly. So tell me about that. How did you meet Stacy? Did she come in for a job at your gym?
Stacy's mom was a restaurateur in Philadelphia, a pretty famous one, as a matter of fact. And Stacy had a couple of brothers who joined my gym right when we opened up. And they dragged Stacy along with them. Stacy, you know, if she was 5 feet one, you know, that was on tiptoes, probably. She was very petite. But, you know, she was like, they used to say about, maybe this is a poor analogy, but like John Grimmick used to say about Steve Reeves when he would come all the way to York to train for the 1950 Mr. Universe contest, I believe it was, in England. As soon as Stacy started training, her body changed almost immediately.
Wow.
And you could see the results happening almost on a day-to-day basis. The little bit of baby fat all of a sudden disappeared, and these beautiful lines. And I would recommend any of your listeners, if they're paying attention to this at all, to maybe Google Stacy Bentley. And you can see what women's bodybuilding looked like really in the late 1970s when it was really in the pure infancy of the sport.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a great time. It was like all of a sudden there was women in the gym who weren't doing cardio. It was women
right.
in the gym who were lifting weights. And, you know, it was a phenomenon. And, you know, even 40 years later, it's still great to see women in the gym pumping iron and lifting weights and realizing that probably, not probably, but definitely the best way to transform their body and to get into great shape is not sitting on the bike. It's working
right.
out in the gym, men and women together training in exactly the same way.
Right, exactly. Because we all have muscles, right?
We all have muscles.
Right. Yeah, what's really interesting about those times, Roger, for people who weren't around back then, was how that sport just took off. And it was so, so popular. And it was covered by the national media, which I think they probably thought it was pretty unique. Obviously it was, that women had muscles, because that was never seen before. And if you look at Rachel and Stacy and Lisa Lyon and some of those women back then, they had great bodies, but they certainly weren't really muscular. I mean, I think most of the women today competing are way, way more muscular. But it really caught on and it really took off. The national media loved it. And pretty soon, these events were being covered on national television. It was really amazing, you know?
It was definitely amazing. I would say if there was any conflict at all, and since I was a judge at that time in the IFBB, it was how do you judge these women? And particularly right after Rachel. I think women's bodybuilding changed in Las Vegas, and I believe the year was 82 or 83, the year that Bev Francis entered the Miss Olympia contest.
And oh, when they did a pumping iron too.
And then all bets were off.
Because all
of a sudden Bev came in with twice as much muscle as anybody else, even Carla Dunlap. way, way more. And they didn't give it to her. She didn't win, but it really changed the focus. And then I think the gate opened up and women started to get involved in what my opinion is maybe the darker side. That's not to say that Beth ushered it in. She was just a naturally muscular, extremely muscular woman who really, you know, I thought really looked great. And I got a chance to meet her, and she's a lovely woman. But because that she had this high testosterone level, and she was so much more muscular than the rest of the women, I think it just allowed women, you know, who to get involved and then to take it to the nth degree, where it is, you know, now, or at least a few years ago, before they ended the Miss Olympia contest. I don't know if they're starting it again.
I think they are. I think this year they're starting and they're bringing it back.
That'll be interesting to see what the criteria is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we could get into a whole discussion about drugs. I mean, we could just say that, in a way, it kind of did ruin the sport of bodybuilding. It created the sport of bodybuilding in a way, but then it kind of ruined it too when it just went too far. And it seems like, I don't know if it's the competitors or the judges or whatever, but they just can't seem to, like, they just keep going for it and they keep pushing it more and more and more. And it gets to a certain point where it ruins the whole aesthetic of the sport. And that certainly was the case with the women.
Yeah, but you're exactly right. And you are so with the men also. It was, when we look back, when did the sport actually really change? And to me, you know, and I'm biased in this. Back, I'm quite a bit older than you, but I look back, looking at the pictures at NABBA contests in the late 40s and early 50s, and I'm sure by that time, Diana Ball was recognized. At least I think so, because Dr. Ziegler brought it over, I think, around that time. But
wow,
the physiques were still, again, you know, you could tell. Everybody looked different, and you would like or dislike a certain physique, and the lines or the symmetry or the muscularity or the bulk or whatever on different bodybuilders. And that remained the same to me, and the sport was growing and great. And maybe it changed, maybe at the 1980 Olympia contest when there was so much controversy, but there wasn't that much controversy before that. Yeah, maybe Sergio beat Arnold one year, maybe Arnold beat Sergio another year. Maybe there was a discrepancy in 72 in Essen, Germany. But in 80, I wasn't there. I could have been there, but I recused myself because I had trained Mike Mentzer previously that summer for the Olympia. But then in 81, of course, with Franco winning. And then, to me, the sport changed a little bit when all of a sudden, out of the blue, you started to see striated glutes on some of the bodybuilders, notably Rich Gasperi. We never saw that when we were younger. Nobody ever even thought about something like that. And to me, that's maybe when the sport really took a turn. And, of course, between 1992 and the 1993 versions of Dorian Yates.
Yeah. Yeah, I just saw an interview with Frank Zane recently, and he was saying that the only time that he can remember where the sport, and at least more in recent times, I guess, where the sport did not reward just size for size's sake was from 1976 to 1983. And that was, you know, 76 was when Franco won and Zane got a real close second, and then 77 through 79, Zane won, and then Arnold and Franco, and then Dickerson and Benoit. So it was in those, I guess if you look at those years, those were the years when, I mean, I always look at like 1983 as a very interesting year because you had guys who were mass monsters like Bertel Fox and Lee Haney, and then you had guys like Muhammad McAway and Samir Benoit and Frank Zane, and they were all in the top five. So some guy, you know, so the judges were still rewarding symmetry then, and they would pick a guy like Frank Zane over Bertel Fox, which was really interesting. And then it's like that would never happen today. You know, a guy like Muhammad McAway would never beat Bertel Fox. A guy like Frank Zane would never beat Bertel Fox. But when you look at it back then, it was interesting how the judges went because they didn't have all the different divisions like they do today. They don't have classic physique and 212. And it was just, and there was no weight classes. It was all one class and all different types of physiques, like you said. And then the judges had to be good enough to be able to recognize, okay, Frank Zane's got the symmetry. He's a great poser. So we're going to put him ahead of Bertel Fox, who's got way more mass, but he's lacking in certain areas. He doesn't have the symmetry. He doesn't look as good relaxed. And also maybe because they judged all three rounds too, you know?
Exactly. I think what you're saying could be epitomized in 1980 because there's so many pictures that have come out of that contest.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that Arnold was really, he wasn't the Arnold of 1974. I'm sure he would have told you that.
Sure.
Also, but he was big. I mean, he was tall. I mean, he's, mm-hmm. I just saw him wasn't 6'1". Most of the other competitors were 5'10 or less. And when he stood next to him in the lineup, I mean, he dwarfed them in certain ways. But if you took a look at the muscularity, he certainly wasn't as muscular as Zane or even Dennis Tenorino or Boyer or Roger Walker in that contest, let alone Mike Mentzer and Chris Dickerson. His triceps were thin. His legs were not the same as 1974. But I guess if I was a judge there, which I wasn't, how do you compare a guy who's so much bigger than to Zane? Arnold was probably 225 pounds.
Yeah, that's
what I
would say.
Probably 10 or 15 pounds off of his best weight. And Zane got hurt before the contest. He was sharp as a pistol, but he was probably 180 pounds. Now, how do you judge the two of them together? I mean, is it, do you go for the muscularity? If you do, then Zane comes out on top. But if you come with big muscles and massive muscles, even though he was not at his best, then maybe Arnold. That contest has been talked about ad infinitum, and there's still no agreement about that contest. I guess there never will be. Like there won't be in 1981, although it was more obvious in 1981 that Franco probably didn't deserve to win that contest. I've written about that a million times, and so has everybody else.
Right. Yeah, getting back to the women, though, talk a little bit about what was so appealing about the women, because if you go back to the days of Rachel and Stacey Bentley, they definitely weren't very muscular. So why do you think the audiences really resonated with that and they really liked what the women had to offer?
Way back in the winter of 1976, as you know, a couple of bodybuilders, Arnold, Ed Corning, and Frank Zane, were invited to New York to pose at the Whitney Museum under the concept of bodybuilding as art.
And right.
I was there. I had gone with John Bailick and Arnold and Ed Corning. And none of them were in shape. I mean, I've written many times that Frank Zane not only looked like he couldn't win Mr. America, didn't look like he would win Mr. Pennsylvania. And less than a year later, he was in the most fantastic shape. They called him the chemist at the time. I didn't understand why, but he really knew how to dial it in, if you know what I mean. So anyway, the point being that the public didn't need to see these guys in contest condition. They were just, and these guys spoke very well. Zane spoke to these people, and Arnold spoke to these people, and they spoke well. And even the elites in New York and the art community, they appreciated it. And then when Lisa Lyon, who was really the first of the beautiful women who was adorning Gold's Gym, got photographed by this Robert Mapplethorpe, who was one of the world's most renowned photographers. It was a phenomenon. It really was. She posed naked in half the pictures, but it was done so tastefully.
Mm-hmm.
Not as Lisa Lyon, woman bodybuilder. It was so great that people wanted to look like her. She didn't look like a muscular marvel. She just looked like a woman who was. She had separation in her thighs. You could see her abs or. She didn't have long muscle bellies or anything like that. It wasn't like she had round muscles, but she looked great, and she was stone gorgeous. And I walked into Gold's Gym in late 1978 and happened to meet her, and she took all the oxygen out of that gym. She looked so good, and she felt so good about herself, much more so than Stacy ever did, by the way. Stacy always had self-doubt that she could really stand up there with some of these women. She certainly could, But Stacy never had the confidence that Lisa Lyons did, or later Tanya Knight, who's another one of the great ones, or Anya Langer, or the woman whose name escaped me who won Miss Olympia, Kiki Aloma.
Yeah.
I mean, these women really, they look great from what I could see on the surface, felt great about themselves. Probably nobody felt better about themselves than Juliette Bergman, who was just up close, spectacularly gorgeous woman with some of the most full muscle bellies you ever saw on a woman. But
yeah.
Nobody would ever say that she was not a feminine, beautiful, magnificent, specimen. She sure was. Some of those women in the 80s, one was Mary Roberts, Claire Furr. They were beautiful, and Claude and all of them were really something else. Candy Sensitive. I mean, mm-hmm. they were beautiful, strong women. Carla Dunlap. It was great times to be around them.
Yeah, so it seemed back then they definitely developed their bodies. And I think maybe the appeal in the beginning was, hey, these are beautiful women who have muscle. And that was, for the media standpoint, I think at least, this was really, really unique. And we never saw that before in the history of time.
And that's why it caught on.
Yeah, and that's why it really caught on with the media. But it seems like the beginning of the women bodybuilders in the 70s and 80s, before they got too heavy into the stuff, they were developing beautiful physiques, but they were also, I think, pioneers in the case of posing, you know, because women, I guess, are more artistic overall, or just maybe more in tune with that type of the sport. And they were really, really effective posers, and they really brought a lot of variety into it and entertainment. And it was just a whole different than the men were doing.
Exactly. You're correct. They were much more artistic. Although Ed Corey and Cliff Dickerson, they could be a match for anybody the way they
played
also.
Right,
but then
you
had the real heavy-handed bodybuilders who came up there and stomped their foot down. Mm-hmm. Like Bertel. Bertel threw most muscular poses. That's what Bertel did.
Yeah.
He had such thick, heavy muscularity, you really didn't care. I remember one night I wrote in Iron Man that Porter Cottrell, who had a wonderful physique, more of the, I guess, you know, the John Hansen type of look, you know, muscular guy, not overly crazy, but really a beautiful physique. And he posed at the time to Over the Rainbow, a very slow song, and he kind of deflated when he went along. I mean, it could have been good, but it just didn't match the man. He needed something more dynamic in that day. And I wrote about it because it was my honest opinion. I stated, this is just an opinion from one judge who saw it. And, you know, gosh, there was no internet at the time, but I got some nasty, nasty mail back. It was just part and parcel of being a judge at the time, though. You know, you know, I was respected strictly because I was honest and approachable. And every one of those physiques, both men and women, knew that after the contest that I didn't run out. I stayed, and I listened, and I took the criticism, and I made my point. And you could like it or you not like it, but it was always honest in a subjective sport.
Speaking of posing, I remember when I was in Chicago, I used to judge a lot of shows, NBC shows, and Mario Saline came in. Remember she lived out there? Didn't she live in Hawaii? Was she from Finland originally? Or?
Yeah, she's a beautiful woman.
Yeah, and I didn't really know much about her. Of course, I knew who she was because I read the magazines, but I don't think I ever saw her in person before. And she came out and she did this posing routine that floored me. I mean, to this day, it's one of the most memorable posing routines I ever saw. I don't remember what music she posed to, but it was just so beautiful. And the way she moved her body and the poses that she did and the way she interpreted it to the music, I was just floored. I mean, I stood up and applauded when she was done. It was just, it blew me away. And it just really showed what posing could do, you know, the potential that posing could be. Of course, you mentioned Ed Corney and Chris Dickerson and Frank Zane, some of the other great posers in our time, McAway, Labrada. But it's just really a shame when we look at bodybuilding today and we never really, we never see that kind of posing anymore. I mean, I don't think I went to the Olympia last year and I didn't see one guy that even came close to that level of posing.
I'm curious, if you went to the Olympia this past year, what, you know, the most exciting moments of any contest, especially an Olympia contest, is the initial walkout of the competitors when they first walk out on stage. At least it definitely was for me throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s when I was involved. How did it manifest to you this year in comparison to how it used to be back in the golden days? Was it the same anxiety? Was it the same feeling? Was it the same excitement? How did you feel about it?
Well, actually, Roger, they don't even do that anymore. They don't bring them all out like they used to. I used to love that when they did that. Now they just say our first competitor, and the guy comes out. They don't do the relax round. They just come right out and do the mandatory poses. And it's really not even the mandatory poses. They just have like about a minute or so to do whatever poses they want to do. But most of them just do the mandatories, you know, double bicep, lat spread, side chest, rear double by, abs, most muscular. They throw in one or two other ones. But they don't bring everybody out until everybody's come out individually. So you don't know what everybody's going to look like till they come out.
But what do you think factored into that decision by the
IFBB
to do something like that?
I don't know.
That to me, that I didn't know that, obviously, and that to me is a real turnoff.
Yeah, because I remember I used to love when they all walked out. It was so exciting.
So did everybody else. I mean, the judges, the fans, the photographers, everybody. And
yeah.
It was amazing because in that first, I'd say in that first 30 seconds,
mm-hmm.
you had an idea, a definite idea who was dialed in and who was.
Right, right. Yeah, it took about 30 seconds, right. I mean, we just looked down the lineup and you could pick your top five right away.
Just about.
I remember Haney used to pretty much win the show in the first minute. You know, when they walked everybody out, he was taller, bigger, wider, with a smaller waist than anybody else. And it's like, wow, there's a show right there. You could tell he's going to win.
Yeah, Boyer Cope, I wrote today, as a matter of fact, and somebody who I was answering a question to online said mm-hmm. a long time ago, it's not realistic for people to expect a professional bodybuilder every year that they would come out on stage to be an improved version.
Yeah.
And he was right. It's honest and it's correct. I don't remember exactly the year. It was the late 80s. I guess I covered it in Iron Man, but Lee Haney walked out and he was definitely improved, quite a bit improved over the previous year. And so mm-hmm. I had to say Boyer Cope was probably correct in his assumption, but this was an aberration of that because Lee Haney did improve. And boy, when he was dialed in, he was the head of the class. He was against some tremendous competition all those years.
Yeah, I wish they would, some of these guys today, especially some of the younger guys, I wish they would kind of go back in history and learn about some of the posing. And they don't have to copy Muhammad McAway or Lee Labrada. They just have to do their own thing. But they should definitely be inspired by guys like that and figure out a way to bring that inspiration to the stage and put together a routine that's going to be something really fun and artistic and beautiful to watch. Man, just unfortunately, most people just don't do it. I think they just do what everyone else does. They just go up to that level and no one ever takes it to a different level. And it's really, really a shame.
I think there's an appreciation in every single sport, baseball, football, basketball, and mm-hmm. even transcends down to bodybuilding, that the people who have been involved in that sport, specific sport, always respect the younger guy who knows the history of the sport.
Yeah.
Which shows their passion, that they're not just up there just to, in a moment in time. They're up there knowing the past
yeah.
and the passion of the sport that they're involved in and are interested enough to care about it more so mm-hmm. than just themselves on stage at that specific time.
Yeah, whenever I interview Sean Ray, you know, when he talks about his career, when he was younger, as a teenager in early 20s, he knew about the guys that came before him. So he was very much aware of the history. And so I think that's what made him such a great bodybuilder and such a great poser.
It must have been frustrating for guys like Sean Ray and Flex Wheeler and
mm-hmm.
Chris Cormier and some of the other really good guys. I don't remember a contest that Sean Ray didn't show up really, really muscular. I mean, he knew how to dial it in. He was
oh, yeah.
sharp. You could always count that he would be in shape when it comes. Vince Taylor. These guys were so good and so
mm-hmm.
Kevin LeBron, you know, he never won the Olympia, but God almighty, these guys were so good. They were so muscular at times. And this is really times when you talk about mass monsters. You had Marcus Rule, you had Nasser Elsenbody, and I mean then there was such a discrepancy or disparity. How do you judge somebody like Nasser opposed to Sean Ray? Really?
Right.
For the most experienced judge. I mean, how do you do it? I'm glad I wasn't judging contests back then. Although at the time that I was doing it, it was always intriguing and it was always exciting. And you had your favorites, but you really tried to be objective. And you didn't always make the greatest friends. Mike Mentzer, I trained previous to the 1980 Olympia that I recused myself, but I had trained with Mike all through the 1970s. And I was there in 1979. He really trained hard for that contest, and he really believed that he beat Zane, because he outweighed Zane by 20 pounds. And there was nothing wrong with his contest condition, but Zane was the more professional that night, and Zane brought it all in the posing round when he really outdid himself. And Mike, in his haste, being his first Olympia, sped his routine so fast and threw the poses so quickly that Zane just performed like a pro and Mike was an amateur. But after the contest, Mike wasn't happy with me. And, you know, I told him the truth. I think he learned from it, to tell you the truth. It was 1980. Even though I wasn't there, I had seen him 2 weeks before. And, boy, he was in the best shape of his life. Now, whether he flattened out when he got to Australia, like some people said, maybe so. But he certainly wasn't flat in Philadelphia and before that contest. He was muscular and really the best I've ever seen him. You never can tell. You just never can tell. The day of the contest, sometimes they miss it. Sometimes they're on the mark.
I'm glad you brought that up, Roger, because I wanted to ask a little bit more about that. All the conversations we had, I don't think we ever talked about you training with Mike Mentzer, who's one of the most iconic and popular bodybuilders ever in the history of the sport. So how did you first meet Mike Mentzer?
You know, Mike, back in the early 70s, wanted to go to med school and become a psychiatrist. A friend of mine was a psychiatrist, and he knew Mike. And Mike at the time was down, he was in Maryland. He was in the Air Force Reserve, if I remember, and he was going to school at the time. And we met. I drove down to Maryland. I think it was Spartanburg, Maryland. I forget the name of the gym, but that was the first time I ever trained with him. We didn't know each other, but we shook hands, and we just hit it off the first time, right then. We became instant friends. I trained with him, Mike, Gold's Gym. I trained with him in Philadelphia. I trained with him in Maryland. And every time we ever trained together, always asked for, and he always did, the same workout. I wasn't around. He trained differently, according to the magazines and according to Casey, who was another friend of mine. Casey went out to meet Mike and Ray at Gold's Gym in 1979, they trained a completely different way. He ever trained with me, but when he trained with me, he preferred Nautilus machines, and that's what we did. I will say in advance, I trained out in Gold's Gym and watched Arnold train, and Draper, and Zane, and Roger Callard, and Denny Gable, and all the great guys. Everybody trained to the way that they thought they were going to get results. It really, you know, to certain people, was the tool. And to certain people, it wasn't. And, you know, certain people just made results whatever they did. Arnold grew, Draper grew. They used barbells. They used machines. They did everything. But these guys, as you know, if you have that potential and if you train hard, no matter what the tool, you're going to stimulate a response. And especially in those days when the drugs were just coming into fashion, they weren't in shape all year round, but contest time, you know, they knew just what to do.
Yeah.
But if you're specifically with Mike, he liked a type of training called free exhaust training, where you work the muscle in isolation or as much in isolation as you can, and immediately followed it up by a compound exercise that brought in the targeted muscle and other muscles to help that targeted muscle train deeper into failure. That's
okay.
How he liked to train. Contrary to what the magazine said and his book said, at least with me and the way he trained at Mainline Health and Fitness prior to the 1980 Olympia, and we had every type of equipment. We had Nautilus, we had Cybex, we had thousands of pounds of free weights. This is the way he chose to train with Nautilus machines, the only exception being a barbell squat.
What body parts did you train with him? Did you train everything with him?
Mike Mentzer, every single time I trained him, or I shouldn't say trained him. I counted his reps. You know, I was there. And
okay.
The times that I trained with Ray Mentzer, and the one time I trained with Casey Theater, and the one time I trained with Danny Padilla, they all trained that way. They wouldn't rest, and they worked their whole body. They worked their legs, back, shoulders, chest, arms, and very rarely their abs. Now, I've read how you train in your life, and you don't do things at all like that. And either did Arnold, and either did most of the bodybuilders. But he did. And since you asked me specifically, this is the way the man trained. He didn't rest during his workout, except momentarily. He trained very, very hard. He wasn't as strong as Ray, and Ray wasn't as strong as Casey.
Wow.
But all three of them were tremendously strong. When he went to California, when Casey went to California in the fall of 1979 and trained with Mike and Ray, they didn't use hardly any Nautilus machines. They did mostly free weights and mostly partials. Mike told me about a month into it, he was sore in his joints, and that's why he stopped doing it. Ray and Casey were both bigger than Mike was. And they were thicker in their bones, especially Casey, than Mike was. And I don't think that they ever got hurt. But the time Casey trained with me, he went through the exact same workout that Mike did. I mean, they trained their whole body, and they use machines, and this is the way they like to train. Amazing.
So give me it is. I didn't know that. Give me an example of, like, an exercise combination Mike would do, like maybe for chest.
I'll tell you Mike's exact workout, how I remember
okay.
today. Mike would start with, there was an old machine called a Nautilus hip and back machine, where you lay on your back and you put your legs down. It kind of worked basically the major muscles of the glutes. But when he didn't do that, he would start with a leg press, then do a leg extension, then a barbell squat, and he wouldn't rest. Then he would do hamstrings and calves.
So he would do, when he was doing legs, Roger, he would do all three of those together? Leg press,
yes.
Leg extension, squat?
Not only did he do them together, but in 1980 when I trained him, he trained 3 days a week like that.
Wow.
Now, he stayed at my house for a period of time, and if Mike was taking any injectables, I never saw them. I know he took orals, but injectables, I never saw it. But other people in the gym, and there was hundreds of us around, John Balick was around. I mean, there was a lot of people who watched these workouts. Anybody else who tried to do the workouts couldn't do it. Nobody else could do it more than once or twice a week, but he could do it three times a week.
Wow.
Why? Was it because of the chemicals or because of his drive to be Mr. Olympia? Whatever it was. Another interesting tidbit I can tell you is that Mike always carried a slight bit of what they say water, but I say body fat, right below his navel. That was his one area. But when I trained him before the contest, or when we trained before he left back to California to go to Australia, that was completely gone. And that's why I said to him, you're going to win this contest. And if you don't, you're going to be the most muscular man in the contest, because I don't know. I can tell you, John, it's the strangest thing. If I hadn't recused myself, I think the whole history of that sport would have changed.
Yeah,
it's ironic. The little things in life happen, and I did the right thing. And I don't ever second-guess myself. It wouldn't have been fair, because I don't think I could have been objective. I think I would have been biased for him. And I liked Arnold, and I liked Roger Walker, and I knew all these guys.
Yeah.
But I think it would have been different if I was there, but I wasn't. So anyway, then his upper body, he would do a Nautilus pullover machine followed by a pull down. So theoretically, the pullover isolates the function of the lats, and he would bring his biceps into dual pull down. He would do what they call a pec deck, you know, what novice called an arm cross, and go right into a decline press. And then he would work traps by doing shrugs, and then he would do lateral raise and overhead press, and then he would do biceps and chin-ups, and triceps and dips. His workout took about 45 minutes, and that's
how he would train. Now, how many sets was he doing for each exercise?
He would do one.
One
set. The workout took 45 minutes. I know it's hard to believe, but his intensity was tremendous. This is the way this one man responded.
It was
totally the opposite of Arnold training 6 days a week. Arnold made results 6 days a week. And when I was out in California, so did Callard and so did Denny Gable. They all trained the same way, and they all
quit
the routine. And we would go to the beach after the morning session, and they would come back at night. But it worked for them. And we're all different. You know, we're all different, and we all respond to different things. And there's as much psychology that goes into it as physiology. This is the way he believed he would respond.
Was he warming up at all before he – because I know he trained heavy, so would he just go right into the heavy stuff?
He would warm up occasionally doing a set of barbell squats lightly. And for him, lightly would be like 225 for about 15 reps.
Okay.
And then when the workout started, after he had done his leg press and leg extension, he would be so thoroughly warmed up. I remember him using something either 315 or 405 for squats. And they would be about 10 repetitions, and that's how he trained.
He would do the extensions, leg press together, and then after that set was over, he would go over and do squats.
He would do the leg press before the extension and then squat.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So he called it a double pre-exhaustion.
Right.
So he did a comp, but on all the upper body, he didn't do a compound movement. Like, he didn't do a bench press and then a pec deck. He would do the pec deck first. And it was amazing because he would get so much blood in the area in his chest, I remember, that his whole chest would turn red from doing that set of arm crosses or pec deck before he even went into the chest press. And he would pump up so much, and his chest, which was criticized many times as his weak area, never looked weak to me. Maybe on stage it was a different thing in 1980. And I can tell you from the pictures, he looked a little flat, but it didn't look flat when I was with him, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Now, when he was, so he's doing these pre-exhaust supersets, and did he take it to failure? Like, would he do force reps, negatives, or would he just do like a positive failure?
He used to always talk to me about rest-pause training, that he really liked to do rest-pause, but I never saw him do it.
Okay.
He would talk about it to me, but I never saw him do it. He would talk about a 4-day split, but I never saw him do it. He was writing his magazines about split routines, and I'm sure he did it, but he never did it with me. I never called the shots, and he certainly never needed to impress me. We were just friends. I mean, you know, we hung out outside the gym. You know, we drank wine together. We went out with two different women who were friends with each other. We did a lot of, he didn't ever have to, we were just buddies.
Yeah.
But this is the way he trained. All I can say to your listeners, this is the way he trained with me. How he trained anyplace else or with anybody else.
He wasn't doing like what Yates would do, where he would do a force rep or two force reps and then maybe even negatives after that.
I can't say he didn't. But it was the exception rather than the rule. He talked about negatives. He talked about force reps. I guess if I was around and I saw that he could do another, I don't remember on occasion, I'm sure, but it was not the rule. He trained awfully hard on his own under my eye. He talked about it and he wrote about it, but I didn't see it a lot. I certainly never, ever saw him with me do rest pause training like I know he said he did with his brother.
Did you see when him and Casey and Ray were training in 79? Did you watch that?
No, I wasn't in California at the time. but I heard it created really a lot of excitement. Can you imagine that? The three of them walking into Gold's to train together.
Wow. No, that's unbelievable.
Heavy barbell work and partial reps. That's what they did. They did half squats. They did partial presses, rack work. I don't know if they ever did any isometric work, but they did a lot of stuff that some people can tolerate and some people can't. You know, some people's joints can handle it and some can't. Mike's couldn't after a short period of time.
Tell me a little bit more how Mike looked before he left for Australia in 1980.
Well, I'd say a month before he left, oh my God, he was in the best shape that I'd seen him in. And remember, I had seen him when we met in 72. I was in New York in 75 when I think he took second or third in the America. I was there in 76 when he won the IFBB Mr. America. I saw him in 77 when he was great. I saw him in 78 when I was sure that he was going to win the Mr. Universe. And he lost to Roger Callard, who I knew Roger Callard also because he trained in a small gym in Philadelphia, and I seen him train. Roger Callard made tremendous results.
I meant Cal Scout.
Cal made tremendous results and quite quickly, especially in his upper body. And with Cal Scout, you could see really how genetics came into play. He had very long muscle bellies in his pecs and his biceps, and they grew like a weed. But his vastus lateralis was somewhat short, and his legs got developed, but they were nowhere near his upper body. So I was surprised in 78 when Mike, it was 77, that was the year that Mike lost to Scalic, and came back again in 78, and he won with a perfect score.
Right.
But in my opinion, I thought he was better in 77 when he lost.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah, but, you know, that's one. You know, I made the mistake, I think I mentioned to you one time, of telling Arnold that I thought he looked better in 70, that I thought he was his best 73. And Arnold let me know in no uncertain terms that he was at his best in 1974. In retrospect, he was certainly correct.
Yeah, yeah. What did Mike weigh in 1980 before he left for Australia?
I'd say Mike probably weighed... We had a scale, but we didn't weigh him. I think it might weigh 211 pounds, 210 to 11, something like that.
Okay.
I don't know what they did. They weigh them in 1980 at the contest?
I think they said he weighed 225, but I didn't believe that. That sounded too heavy to me.
No, he wasn't that heavy because then he would have been as heavy as Arnold.
Right.
And he wasn't.
Right.
That contest, in a way. If there wasn't a discrepancy, it would have been called the greatest Mr. Olympia because so many guys were in the fantastic shape that day. If you saw the way Boyer Co. looked that day, and Dennis Tinerino, and Roger Walker, and Chris Dickerson, and even though Zane was light, he was so sharp.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys were really, really good that year. The only one who was really off in 1980 was Casey. And he made up for that in 1982 when he almost won the Olympia.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Before we go, Roger, I want to talk a little bit about 2019 because we had really a bad year for bodybuilding. We lost Ed Corney, I think, on January 1st of last year. And then we lost Franco in August, shortly after his birthday. And then in the fall, we lost Josef Wilkosch from Germany. So three real legends from the 1970s and 1980s. We lost them all in one year.
Yes, and before that, we lost a lot of other great guys. We lost Munzer, and we lost Omo Benaziza, and a lot of these guys who I knew and who I judged. And it's really sad. I didn't, you know, Wilkosch, I know, had been in a kind of depression. I think he had domestic issues. I think he had been sad for quite a while. Franco really surprised me because Franco always seemed to be, you know, really in shape and had that joie de vivre, you know, that joy of life that I
could
he could live forever. And Courtney, I think, has been ill for a while. So that, that didn't take me by surprise. It does touch you a little bit when you're involved for so many years to see so many of the guys you knew starting to pass away. And it's very, very sad. I think if you would ever get Peter McGuff, to on your show, he was around for a long period of time and really saw so many contests. He's the fountain of information about bodybuilding. And there's another guy named Bill Hinburn who's so bright, and he's sort of a historian of the sport, and Steve Winterstrom. They were around when I was around, and they knew all these guys too, and I'm sure it probably touched all of them personally, John Balick being another one. Just great guys who could really talk about this all day long, just like I could.
Yeah. Well, we had
you. It's been a sad year, and I hope 2020 is a little bit easier on the guys we learned to love in our sport.
Yeah, well, we had you on last year when we did that tribute for Ed Corney, and that was sad because I saw Corney at his best, and we both did in 1977 when he got that standing ovation, and Mr. Olympian got third place. And we saw him many years after that, and you saw him probably before that also. But Franco really surprised me, and that I was really sad. And I think a lot of people were. You know, I talked to Jerry Branham after Franco passed away, and it was just such a shock. I remember when I saw it on Facebook, I couldn't even believe it. And then I learned that he drowned, and it was really, really sad because I grew up with these guys, and I saw Pumping Iron when I was 14 years old. And of course, Franco was a big part of that movie, and I saw him win the 81 Olympia. Of course, you see him all the time at the Arnold Classic. He's just a legend, you know. He's just one of those golden era legends. And I was really, really shocked when he passed away.
You know, a lot of people can get mad at the internet for an awful lot of reasons. But I looked at it like on my Facebook page the day after, or several days after Franco died, to write my recollections, specifically one evening that we spent together and talked. And it drew a tremendous response from a lot of the guys in the game, just like I did several weeks ago when Stacy Bentley passed away. So sometimes you can use the internet and Facebook or however media you use to tell a story that's accepted and it's not controversial by anyone. And you can make a good thing out of something that's not always so advantageous. But Franco, that was a very sad thing for me because I remember before 1981, that contest that I judged that Franco won, when I was the head judge, I had seen him in Philadelphia earlier that year. And that's what my eulogy to him reflected, a night that we spoke before that contest. And he was so excited to come back and over a glass of wine. And I was so happy for him. And he came to the contest, and the first moment he came out, I said, this is not going to be his night. Mm-hmm. It was really a shame because he trained so hard for it. You know, it's not like he was small. He was very, very muscular, but he was just balanced. I mean, he had the gyno in one pec and his leg, through no fault of his own, through the contest where, you know, he broke his leg carrying the refrigerator, you know, the strongest man. He did tremendous things with his body, but it was not to be that night. And so it was bittersweet when he won that. I felt great for him, and I felt bitter for the sport, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and a lot of people remember Franco from that 81 Olympia, but when he passed away, I wrote an article about him, and I went back and I looked back at his whole history. And back in the early 70s, like 1970, 71, 72, he was so, so good, man. He was just unbelievable, and he was winning everything. He won the IFBB Universe. He won the World. He won the Mr. International when they had it in Tijuana, Mexico. He won the Mr. Europe. I mean, he was just, and he was a little guy, you know, 5'4", 5'5", and he was beating all these big guys in open contests. But he had a look that was just so unique back then, especially. He was so dense and so thick and so muscular. I don't think anybody else had that look. And he had his weaknesses. I mean, his legs were never as shredded or as separated as his upper body. But God, this upper body was just so dense and thick. And ripped, and just so thick. He really was a great, great bodybuilder, especially when you look back at him when he started.
I think if I have one regret in all the time I was involved was that I never attended a NAPA Mr. Universe contest because the stories of the competitors coming back home for the most part were they were very, very professional. They were on the up and up all the time. And before the Olympia, you would see tremendous fields of competitors. And in the early 70s, you would see Franco competing against, you know, Chris Dickerson. Mm-hmm. And he would compete against Pierre Vandenstine, I believe. And a couple, even Ricky Wayne, I think. They would go to London that one time a year, and the contests would, you know, they'd have great guys in each of the three height classes in the amateur, and anybody could win, and they were great contests. I never was there, and I saw the reports and I saw the pictures, but, you know, it never takes the place of being there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sad year. We lost a lot of great guys. So Stacy Bentley died right at the end of the year, right? So wasn't that like December 30th?
Stacy passed away on the 30th of December, is correct.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a shame. I guess it's all part of life, though, right? I mean, as we get older, it's going to happen more and more.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, it's wonderful talking to you. I enjoy these, and you call, and I'll be there for you. I respect what you're doing, and I hope that your listeners respect what you're doing, and it really adds on to talk back about what was truly the golden era of bodybuilding.
Yeah, it's always great talking to you too, Roger. And I think I said this before, I used to read your articles in Iron Man when I was a kid. So it's really great that I get to talk to you all these years later, one-on-one, and we get to talk about those great days of bodybuilding.
Well, I'll always be there for you. My best to you. Keep on training hard. I think you look great. Once
Thank
a year,
you.
You try to hit your peak once a year, and you seem like you're able to achieve it. So
yeah. Thank you, Roger. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Bye-bye, John.
All right, take care. All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, you ready, guys? You ready for it? Next week, our guest will be three-time Mr. Olympia, Frank Zane. We will see you guys then. Take care, everybody.